This episode was originally recorded for the Mormon Mental Health Podcast and is being refurbished here for your enjoyment.
Hi, welcome to Mormon Mental Health Podcast. My name is Jeff Lundgren. I'm a host of this podcast, and I'm super excited today to welcome a guest with us. And her name is Rachel. She is a therapist, and she's had a private practice for a couple of years. And Rachel, you work a lot with faith transition. So I'll introduce or have Rachel introduce herself in a minute. Just a little bit about this podcast. So this podcast is funded through donations. So if you would like to contribute financially, you can make a donation through the website. If you would like to donate in another way, for example, you can collaborate by commenting on Facebook posts, social media, from the website, or even sharing this broadcast with other people. That's a fantastic way to contribute as well. And of course, we are super open to your feedback. So if there's something that you hear, something that you would like us to maybe talk about that you haven't heard about, like reach out through any of those ways, and we would be more than happy to do a podcast on that. So let's get started with today's topic. It's going to be super fantastic. Rachel, introduce yourself a little bit. Tell us a little bit about you.
Hey, my name is Rachel Brown. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I have a private practice right now available for virtual appointments only, and mainly work, as you mentioned, with those experiencing faith transition or changing their relationship to the LDS Church. And having experienced my own faith transition, I think it's one of the most rich and illuminating experiences of my life, and I really enjoy reframing the experience in all the ways that it can be complex and challenging as an opportunity for growth and creation. And that's been really rewarding.
Fantastic. And you and I have similar educations, at least postgraduate ASEC training, which focuses on primarily on human sexuality, healthy behaviors and attitudes, and, you know, interventions for sexual concerns.
Yes.
And then I think that helps, because the topic of today is going to all be about sex. Not all about sex, but at least about an aspect of it, which, as a trigger warning, because we are going to be talking about sexual concerns and things, it's possible that we could bring up something that may invoke some type of a response that would be uncomfortable. I don't think so, but, you know, if sex and topics around sex is a difficult thing for you, then proceed carefully, or at least with that information. We're primarily going to talk today about the six principles of healthy sexuality. And we're going to talk about these six principles from our clinical experience, and also as we understand the contrast between what, from a secular perspective or a non-religious perspective, how we view and how we balance healthy sexual behaviors and thinking around what is common in the Mormon experience, what we're taught growing up, what we're taught into adults, you know, being single, married, all of the stuff. So this is going to be a fascinating conversation. The six principles, we're taking these from the work of Douglas Braun Harvey, who wrote a book a number of years ago called How to Treat Out-of-Control Sexual Behavior. And it's a fantastic academic piece, and he originated, I believe, these six concepts. So there's six principles we'd like to go into, and the first of these is consent. And I think probably out of all of the six, this is probably, I think, the foundation that's an important thing to talk about. Maybe that's why it's number one, which is consent. Consent being, hey, I want to agree to this. And not just consent as a yes, but a hell yes. Very much informed. Like, we use the term informed consent. And the idea is that, do I understand completely? Do I agree completely with what's being offered to me? Is this relationship? Is this thing that we're going to do or experience, am I all on board? And am I all on board fully? Is this something that I'm signing up for? And it's interesting, because I don't think that the Mormon experience really talks a lot about consent.
No. And in fact, one thing that I would say is pretty common in relationships that take place within the context of the LDS Church and culture is perhaps the idea that sex between married people is something that is done to another person by another person, and one person perhaps just becomes available for that experience, rather than it being, as you said, a full intact yes from their own their own free will and choice, right? And although that phrase is used a lot, I think that it actually breaks down a bit within relationships and even within the person, because it's expected, and so much of our sex education that we do receive is based on this future relationship where we're available for this other person in this way. And I never heard anything growing up really about how to check in with my own body. I never heard that it was possible that even if I was married, I might want to say no sometimes. I didn't hear those things. I know a lot of my clients didn't receive that education either. And an important aspect of consent is being able to say no if that's what's wanted. Being able to recognize the desire or lack thereof or ambivalence thereof within oneself and being able to communicate that, having permission for that intact no to be received and accepted, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's a gender bias typically. There's implied consent. Because we're married, it's always a yes. Right. Or because I'm a man, somehow my standing in our relationship gives me certain privilege that I don't need to ask because I'm assuming that that's all or none. And it's always yes if I want to say, let's do this.
Correct. And even if you look at the, if you look at sort of the context of what is a common scenario of perhaps two young individuals who have been told that they can only engage sexually if they get married first in the temple, if they get sealed, I think that there can be a lot of pressure placed on these initial engagements and not a lot of education or permission to slow down and go at your own pace even after marriage. And that's something that I've personally seen a lot of trauma accrued from that experience. Like, can you say no or slow down or I need information once you're already married?
Is it okay to say no?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think oftentimes the perception is a no with a sexual bid means I don't like you, I don't want you, I'm not in love with you, opposed to a no is okay. That doesn't mean it's always going to be a no. And if it's a no, tell me more about that, right? It dismisses curiosity.
Absolutely.
And I think you're right. I think the problems occur when there's this implied response to certain experiences, like, okay, well, now we're married in the temple, now the floodgates are open, so to speak, and any type of behavior is perfectly appropriate. There's no question. Hey, would you be okay in blah, 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 blah? Is this something that you would be okay with? Is this something that you're in the mood for right now? And a no is okay, but the questions aren't asked.
Right. And there can be a lot of discomfort in having conversations about sexual topics anyway, which makes consent more difficult.
Right.
Right.
Well, and I think, I don't know, I always want to rank the thing that's in my mind as the most important thing or the biggest problem. But I think the biggest problem, as I think about it right now, that what's taught is abstinence. Mm-hmm. Not consent. Mm-hmm. And when you're taught abstinence, there is no discussion. There's no consent because what's okay is what's acceptable on one side of the abstinence fence. And what's not okay or shouldn't be discussed or shouldn't be done is on the other side of the fence. And that line, I think it on one level assumes that everybody's exactly the same, that everybody's values and experiences would be the same, and they're not. People are far more diverse.
Right. And the lack of education, I think, is a real hindrance here in as far as like understanding and knowing oneself and even being able to connect with the experience of desire and discern one's own feelings can be an ongoing issue there with being able to, as you say, give a full hell yes.
Yeah. Yeah, hell yes. I think that's important to emphasize that if one partner is saying, hey, are you open for this? And they're like, sure.
Right, right. That ambivalence.
Right, that ambivalence. It's like, hey, you don't sound like that you're really wanting to participate or do this. Can you tell me more? We don't know what the answer could be. It has to be yes. Yes, yes.
I think when I reflect on the education I received growing up in the church and also what has been consistent for many of the clients I meet with, there is a lack of sovereignty in the body, right? One might have the idea getting married, going into sex, not having much experience even with this person they're now eternally committed to. They might have an idea of, I'm going to show up for this other person, and that's how I'm going to be in our marriage, rather than I really know and understand my body and what I need, and recognizing it's okay for your body to need and have different responses at different times. All of that is normal. All of that's natural. Mm-hmm. And a loving partner will honor that and move wherever you need to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's fantastic. I think I see in my practice this gap of practicing informed consent, primarily in the way you've described, where one partner does not feel that they have the permission or the confidence or the language to say no. And it makes for an imbalance that can lead to a lot of other types of dysfunction.
Right. Or even seeing no, as you mentioned, as something that is going to be offensive or hurtful to their partner. Rather than really what we want to emphasize here is consent isn't just for the protection of the individual, but for the relationship and for the potential of love and romance within the relationship. Being able to feel heard and being able to be understood exactly where you are in every moment and have that be acceptable. Being able to change a yes to a no, if that's necessary, and have room in the relationship for that to also be accepted and honored.
Right? Absolutely.
Right.
I think we often discount the power of the yes. I mean, what is it like to have your partner say, no, not right now? And then later say, yes, please, now is a perfect time. That's pretty hot, right? But if it's always a yes, if there's no flexibility and breathing in the yes-no dynamic, hopefully it's more yes than no. But if there's never a chance for a no, then the yeses are not amazing.
Right. If it's not safe to say no, the yes is questionable.
Right? Correct.
Yeah. Because we all move in rhythms with our breath, with our bodies, with our cycles, with our lives. And being able to become attuned to the rhythm of another one is actually a really beautiful thing.
I love that. Thank you. Anything else you want to say about consent?
I think I'm good.
Fantastic. The second principle is the concept of non-exploitative, not exploiting your partner. I think that's pretty easy to understand, right? If you're being manipulated or coerced into saying yes in any way, then there's something unhealthy about that request.
Right. With this principle, I think what is important to emphasize is that it's not the sex that is problematic. It's the exploitation, which is based in the power differential that we're assuming exists in a relationship of exploitation. One person having undue power or coercive power over another person is the problem. And what I see happening very sadly in cases sometimes of really serious sexual abuse is that when sex itself is sort of, there's some agitated energy about it in the culture, oftentimes the exploitation isn't recognized as a problem of a relationship of power over someone else, but the person who engaged in some kind of sexual experience then feels like they did something wrong by not stopping it, right? Mm-hmm. Or not anticipating or predicting it. When you look at the relationships themselves, it's usually pretty clear if exploitation is happening, if one person is in clear objective power over the other one emotionally, because of a position of authority, because there's some kind of financial exchange. And so I think it's always good to just look at that and then recognize that it wasn't that a sexual thing happened between two people that was a problem, but that a relationship of power was misused in this way.
I think that's exactly right. And I don't think that either of us would suggest that there aren't power differentials in most relationships. In some way, someone earns more money, somebody may be more intelligent. There may be a dual relationship that might be within a healthy scope of their engagement that can be complicated. What do you do when you find yourself in a relationship? I would ask you this. What do you do if you find yourself and you identify, they actually have this power in this way over me? How do you negotiate that so that this particular aspect of these principles doesn't feel violated?
You're talking about like potentially within a marriage.
Could be a marriage.
So if I were looking at this, I think that the key thing would be to go look at where is the imbalance of power and where is desire, where is transaction, what is transpiring between these people, and just get more information about that.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it could open up to a healthy discussion. So devout members of the church would subscribe probably to the concept that the man is the head of the house. He's the priesthood holder. Therefore, there's already an implied power differential in that way. If that's one's belief, I think that's okay. I think there can be some problems with that. But if they're holding that as a value important to them, that they're the leader of the family, blah, 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 at least put a spotlight on it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And a question that he might ask her is, hey, have you ever felt that because I'm the priesthood holder or because I'm the head of the household, does that give me a power over you? And invite a conversation that could then allow for the power differential to remain, but not be a factor in how they intimately engage.
Yeah, I think certainly opening a dialogue about it would be helpful. And then perhaps even going back to the first principle, can you comfortably have a conversation acknowledging that there maybe are these power differences, and then say, do you ever feel like you say yes when you want to say no?
Right.
Do you ever feel that if you say no, you'll be in trouble somehow or be punished somehow? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be sometimes that there isn't the intent for that, but that's still the experience of one. Right. And so giving permission to speak to those things and make shifts or changes is necessary, so that both, because I do think it's fair to say that regardless of context, both individuals in a relationship are individuals, sovereign individuals first, and should be able to create a dynamic that honors both of them, where mm-hmm. they both feel that they have power in the relationship in the way that they're able to give that to each other.
Fantastic. I love that. All right. So the third principle is protection against unwanted pregnancy or STI or sexually transmitted infections. And I'll use the term STI, which almost sounds like a car, like, because it is. But what about my STI? It's the Subaru. No. We're talking about sexually transmitted.
STIs in the shop.
Right. So STI, right? Obviously, that's not something that you would want to experience. And so, and this could be a broad topic. We could certainly talk a little bit about how people do this, what kind of conversations. I think it's also important to talk about the awareness of it, the education of it. How does our Mormon experience impact or influence us not having conversations around these things?
One thing that comes to mind, that in just a bit of personal disclosure, is beliefs around birth control. I think this is probably something that's changing now, but my first husband and I were both raised in families that talked about how birth control was sort of the slower track for people who weren't righteous enough to keep the commandments, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had a mission companion that we were talking one night, and I told her that sometimes, selfishly, I thought it would be fun once I got married to have a year or two with my partner before we had kids, to just get used to being together and just be able to kind of have fun and do whatever we wanted and be married and not have to be parents yet. My companion, who was someone that I really looked up to a lot as sort of a spiritual mentor, sighed sadly and she said, I used to feel that way until I realized that anything other than immediately having children is a form of idolatry.
Wow.
And that really impacted me, because I was sensitive to all the ways that things I wanted were against the commandments, right? But the reason I bring it up is because I think that it's possible to have the desire to have children and have that be a wonderful thing in your life, but also to be able to make that choice when you feel ready, I think is important. And to have permission around that if you are the one who's going to have a baby, it really is okay to consider your own wellness, to consider your own physical and mental wellness, and maybe decide that you're going to honor your own timetable more than what other people might want for you and your family or community, or even in the relationship. I think that it's important to really have space for creating the family structure that's right for you. I know in my case, I felt like it would be uncomfortable for me to insist on certain things for contraceptives. And I think that I'm probably not the only person who felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there are other situations where there is maybe a bit of self-abandonment, in the sense of thinking, whether this is in the case of pregnancies or STIs, that someone else will kind of take care of it for us and make sure that there's no issue with it.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's really good to take full responsibility for our own sexual wellness in this way, and recognize that nobody else is going to handle that for us, as far as disclosing things that might be important, as far as STIs, or taking precautions to ensure that pregnancy doesn't occur, but just to really be self-owning about that.
Right. No, I think you really brought up some really powerful concepts. What I heard also, I think I'll build on, is this idea that we receive messages from our culture, right? Our religious experiences, our families, our physicians, doctors, there's a lot of voices. Hey, you should consider getting pregnant now or later or in this way or under these conditions. And I think we're bombarded subconsciously with these ideals that we then inherit and we apply to our belief system without consciously structuring that in a way that feels like it's honoring what our wishes are and also within the contract of our relationships. You know, maybe as you pointed out, our spouse may or may not be on the same page. There could be some differences there. And are we going to then just impose and adopt the church's perspective on when pregnancy is appropriate without those discussions? I think it happens more than it should. I also find it interesting. We don't really hear a lot of educational or talk about educating kids on STIs because abstinence implies that there is no risk for an STI. Or even pregnancy, for that matter. So we don't really need to talk about it. Let's just say, please don't have sex before you're married. And what I've experienced in my office, right, which is where we're sitting right now, is clients have said, I got an STI, and I'm a member of the church. What do I do about this? I didn't think that was possible. And they didn't even have intercourse to get it, mm-hmm. right? So I think it's helpful to understand that there needs to be an awareness that's created for people that are engaging in any type of sexual activity to understand what are the risks, how do you significantly reduce or prevent those things from happening if it's not something you want, like pregnancy, and how do you apply that in contract with your partners or your partner that actually feels comfortable to how you look at those things, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And I think it's worth mentioning that the statistics for sexually transmitted infections show that some of these things are rather common. I think the numbers, and I don't remember exactly whether, but I think it's like 60% of people by the time they reach to adulthood will contract at least an STI once. Mm-hmm. That's super high.
Mm-hmm. More than
right?
half.
More than half. So right. This is not an insignificant thing. In other parts of the world with less resources and education, the numbers are even remarkably higher, which is unfortunate because some STIs come with a serious...
It can be chronic.
Chronic, like an impact for them. They could, and not all, right? Sometimes they're very treatable and it's not that big of a deal. But it's worth, I think, knowing what those are and having those conversations.
Having conversations and also, when necessary, getting tested, getting information that way. Right. And mm-hmm. it's also okay to request that of a new partner mm-hmm. before you have a contractual
for sure
exchange.
And those can be really difficult questions. How do you ask a new partner, hey, who was your last sexual partner with or when was that? And what did that involve? Have you ever been tested for an STI? Who within a Mormon umbrella would ask that before they go to the temple? Right. They, you wouldn't. You just wouldn't.
Right. These conversations are not modeled for us, and we don't typically have mentors that speak to us about these things.
Correct. Or even the use of contraceptives in intercourse. Hey, can you hold on a second? I need to, you know, put on a condom. Like, how romantic is that? Right. And so how do you do that in a way that doesn't derail the direction of that activity in a romantic and provocative way? How do you do that? Right. There's no discussion. These things, they seem like they're intimacy killers. And so people will choose in the moment, oh, I guess I just won't do that. Well, that's out of alignment with their goals in preventing unwanted pregnancy, perhaps.
Yeah. And I think even this idea of them being intimacy killers is an invitation for us to push back against being perhaps overly accommodating mm-hmm. of our partners. And in a way, I think it's actually push back against patriarchy. Because intimacy killer, well, the intimacy is always there for us to experience as soon as we drop in and connect, right? It's not going anywhere, but you know what maybe does is an erection. That's okay too. That can come back too.
Right.
So I think even the idea that you could do something to disrupt a flow and that will be perhaps too disappointing to bear, it's just so much more important to take care of your health. And if this is, you know, even if it's a casual, like, if it's a casual relationship, if it's a long-term relationship, the health of the relationship will ultimately be bettered by just sharing your vision for sexual health, right? Even as you're making out, if that's how far it's gotten, like, hey, this is important to me. I'm really excited to be with you. I would really like to make sure that we have protection, right? Or, hey, this is really exciting. I really want to do this again with you after we both get tested.
And how can we incorporate, right? And how can we incorporate that into our play? Mm-hmm. This doesn't need to be a clinical experience of putting on a condom, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I wow. So yes. There, I don't think women feel empowered to say, hey, I need you to do this. I want to engage in sexual intercourse with you, and I need you to wear a condom. Mm-hmm. It's almost like, well, if they want to, can I even say that? Are they going to reject me? Of course they would know that. I just want to reach out to these women and say, mm-hmm. please speak up.
Yeah.
Please say something.
Yeah. Well, and what I would say too is, this is if there's someone who's sexually desiring you, trust yourself. You are not here being passive, begging for attention or begging for love. They get to be with you. And if they value you, they also should value your safety and your vision of wellness for yourself, your vision of respect for yourself. If that's not there, maybe there's other red flaggy things about this situation.
Right.
Right? But when your voice is diminished in all of these ways that we've kind of been talking about with cultural messaging and scripts, I think that not only leads to poor outcomes, but probably less satisfying encounters, right?
Lack of vulnerability just squashes that.
Right. So rather than framing any of these discussions as awkward or difficult, even if they're not, if it's not a space that you've stepped into before, I would encourage everyone to see this as, it's almost like a restorative prayer to wholeness to have these conversations. I'm not just going to step into this current of culture the way it's been going. I'm me. And if you're here with me, this is what I want for myself. This is what I'm willing to give my partners. And this is what I expect my partners to give to me too.
Yeah, I love that. And I like what you said about red flags. If you're getting some pushback, if you're feeling that you can't express what you need, or you're not clear how to do that in a way that doesn't involve, you know, some type of...
If it feels unwelcome.
Right?
Yeah.
Maybe we need to back up and say, hey, is there consent here? Mm-hmm. Am I being manipulated here? Mm-hmm. Or am I out of step with my values, which we'll get to? I think that's an important understanding.
Right, right. And that's a brilliant link to what you said earlier. That's the real intimacy killer, right? Is someone who's unwilling to have the conversation or would express disappointment or disgust, I think that's less attractive.
It is much less attractive. Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about honesty.
Well, why not just talk about honesty?
Right? I mean, well, okay. Yes, honesty. Okay, check. Now let's go on to the next one. I think there's a lot here.
Yes.
I don't know that it warrants rich. A lot of discussion, but, you know, when I was at first exposed to these concepts, I thought, well, of course you would be honest with somebody. You would not to lie to somebody else. But I also think it's important that you're honest with yourself.
Well, and I just want to say something here as we're beginning this conversation. I think this even is connected to desire itself, right? So I want to say something here about the disconnection I believe that many feel from their own desire. Because if you think about it, in the culture, desire sometimes shows up as a word that's linked to wickedness, mm-hmm. right? It's yep. often linked to wickedness. And we also really acknowledge that healthy desire takes place in these certain contexts, but there's really no information giving about what that feels like or how to know if it, what is my desire even, right? And I've had a lot of clients come to me and say that they feel like they perhaps have never been attracted to their spouse, but they really admired them for being so righteous, or they were really nice to them, or they had this really good friendship. And so that was kind of why the relationship transpired the way that it did, but never able to like really tap in and acknowledge that this is something important. Do I feel physically attracted to this person that I'm going to now be married to?
Are they
for
being
eternity?
Honest?
Are able to be honest with oneself about Correct. One's desires is sort of what I'm wanting to acknowledge. I think that sometimes there's work to be done to re-engage with intuition if it's kind of always been suppressed or rejected or dismissed, right? Mm-hmm. One's own desire, I think, is the most important thing to get honest about down at the root, down at the bones. Honesty with oneself about one's own desires isn't necessarily an innate practice. Sometimes it's something that you have to reclaim or reconnect with, and is ultimately, I think, very rewarding, because once you know yourself and understand yourself, then it's just understanding how to put it into words for other people. But this is actually where I see most of my clients struggle the most, mm-hmm. is I should feel this way, but I don't, but I want to, so I'm going to try to, or I know I do feel this way, but I don't like it. And I have conflict with it. I'm at war with it. But being centered, honest with oneself where you are, what you want sexually from yourself, from other people, I think is the first piece here.
I do too, because I think we would agree, if you're not able to be fully honest with yourself, then you will be inhibited, and some amount of lack of honesty with yourself prohibits or slows down the ability to have a satisfying and amazing sexual experience or relationship. You're faking it.
Right. I think it's okay to acknowledge that sometimes in the environment that we find ourselves in, we may feel that there are certain things that we can never express. And if we feel that way, I think that that's an important place to go. To say, I actually feel like in our relationship, if I were to say certain things, they wouldn't be heard or I would be in trouble. Mm-hmm. And so how can we cultivate a more safe place for both of us? Or if it can't be completely safe, how can we make agreements around a conversation where honesty can take place, but like we're not quite there yet, but I want to be able to be completely sure. honest with you. How do we get there?
Sure. And I think there's a delicate balance at some point is if one is navigating off out of a situation where they haven't been honest with themselves or their partner, how do you go from that place to a point of complete transparency that's appropriate? Because I think sometimes we value transparency more than we should, right? Because we liquidate all of the healthy boundaries that might exist. So there's this navigation between out of an unhealthy space of dishonesty into an appropriate space of honesty and appropriate transparency that builds and increases the quality of the relationship and the satisfaction of sexual experiences and a powerful sense of autonomy, right?
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so delicate. And I don't think we're taught that at church, right? It's, hey, well, you're married, so you're going to have this kind of sex. And if you have a very assertive partner, I think is more commonly the man in the relationship, that how they want to conduct sexual activity may not be what she wants to do, right? And this becomes complex because not all relationships are the same, but I think this component of honesty is super important.
It's definitely a good place, I think, to check in as far as wellness. Like, how does this feel? What is being shared? What is not being shared? And just a good assessment for sexual health in general.
Absolutely. One of the activities I like to do with couples when I see couples around topics of sexuality is a inventory of the types of things that they're interested in or not. And then to mash that up together and say, hey, it looks like you're both very open to this. Or I noticed that this isn't something that you were both on the same page about, but we've talked about it. And I'm curious, is this something that you would like to change in your relationship? Have you ever talked about it? It is so interesting to see when a space for honesty and expression is created, how people will fill that with things that they're very interested in and how it changes the quality of the relationship.
Beautifully said.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about shared values. That would be the fifth principle, shared values. And I think it's important to say, and I talk to clients about this, a value is not a belief. It's not an attitude. It's not a behavior for sure. It's this underpinning foundational thing that you hold of importance. So a sexual value would not be celibacy. Celibacy is a behavior. And it's not that that's wrong. That could be perfectly appropriate. But what underpins that might be something like obedience, which would be a value, or safety. I don't want to engage in sexual behaviors before I get married because I, for whatever reason, feel that that would be the thing that would create the most safety for me. Those would be values. Can you talk about values a little bit?
My understanding of values is, as you said, just something that's important to you. And I think this is a rich area for discussion where perhaps there's a partnership and one member has left the church and maybe there was a shared value of something like, we don't masturbate because we're married and we have this person that we're going to go to for our sexual needs. That might be something that shifts when someone's beliefs change. Their sexual values might also shift. And what I have found to be a good grounding place for this is sort of a reclamation of one's own sexual self, that you can say, I value this for me. It's okay if you don't value it for you, but I also value our relationship. And so I don't have to become absorbed in an enmeshed way in the things that you value, but is there room for me and room for you where we both be healthy together? mm-hmm. when there's a values difference there. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a very good area to look at enmeshment and codependency, and to find spaces where moving to a space of autonomy and ownership of one's own values often kind of brings out some beautiful aspects of the relationship when you're able to just ground in yourself and say, this is me, this is you. When we come together, it's beautiful. How do we come together?
Yeah. And when we do come together, are we intersecting our relationship or our sexual experiences because of our shared values? Do we know what they are? How do they inform us? What types of attitudes do they create, and how do those attitudes influence our behaviors, right? Whether it's masturbation, the use of pornography within or without the relationship, how we perceive non-monogamy could be a big component of this, how we frame and or prioritize some of the things we've even talked about. Perhaps there's a value that influences the importance of safety around the prevention of an STI or unwanted pregnancy, and that's paramount. In contrast to perhaps, we haven't gotten there, but mutual pleasure. It might be perfectly okay to say, yeah, this isn't my thing, but I'm okay with it. Absolutely okay with it. And let's do that, right? There's a compromise. And maybe it's because there's a value of acceptance or allowance or tolerance in a relationship to say, look, I'm okay in doing something that isn't my first choice. And I'm not really saying that I really enjoy it, but I feel satisfied in the relationship and I'm willing to share that. Again, the values change. But if we engage in the relationship, I think we've kind of alluded to this, if we engage in the relationship and we're not aware of the values, or we're highly conflicted in the way in which our values intersect, then there may be something that's disrupting the experience in some way.
I think this is a good place to acknowledge the concept of sex positivity too, that we can make space for differences in likes and dislikes and curiosities by just recognizing it's okay for people to be themselves and to be drawn to what they're drawn to. It doesn't necessarily mean that we need to be exactly like them, but like you said, sometimes we can meet them where they are.
Right. Yeah, I think that's accommodating. I think that's very Christ-like, right? To say we accept other people where they're at. I think we could probably go on a huge diatribe on attitudes towards LGBTQ, you know, IA people who have a diversity of experiences and attitudes and things that make them unique and wonderful. Yet the values that we think that everybody should adhere to may be different for others. And that's perfect. Like, it should be that way. Mm-hmm. I had a thought around values too. You talked about this a bit earlier, but when people transition in their relationship with the church or out of the church, oftentimes that can feel very threatening to their partner. Oh no, my husband or my wife no longer believes. They're probably going to have an affair. They're probably going to start, you know, looking at porn if they haven't already. And it opens a lot of unknowns. There can be a lot of anxiety around what happens after some type of a transition. And I think that condition is actually created because of the church culture, which says that your values are given to you. Therefore, if you no longer affiliate with the church in the same way, then your values will be revoked and you will choose to separate yourself from those values. And that's not true. At least it's not generally true. Most of the time, I think that people are super congruent over their lifetime and the values that they hold sacred. There may be some adjustments and small iterations in that, but I think generally those stay the same. So when I work with clients in a faith transition that are in a committed relationship, I often talk about those values. Well, what were your values not given to you by the church? This is a value that I hear all the time, although it's really not a value. The value that I hear all the time is, I want to be pure. I want to be chaste. I want to be clean, right? Well, what does that mean? I can hold space that chastity could be a value, cleanliness as a value. But I think what we're really talking about is worth and value and how the divine would perceive us, or how we're perceived by our peers in our community more than anything. How do we make space for what's really important? And can we find and identify and label the value that a transitioning spouse might have, so that we don't feel that their change and their relationship with the church is going to be a cause to injure the quality of the relationship?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the discussion about feeling threatened by someone else's sexual values is salient, regardless of whether someone is actually leaving or transitioning out of the church, because I do see that there is a lot of pain and a lot of agitation and just in general, and I think maybe just to say it in a broader general sense, I think it's a common experience even for married partners to find the other's sexual values threatening to them, mm-hmm. right? And so I think that there's some interesting anthropological work we can do there in how those ideas were taught and absorbed, right? Because why does someone else's preferences ever threaten me? If I go to lunch with my friend and she orders something different on the menu, I don't go, well, I would never order a stuffed avocado, right? So I would just say, oh yeah, you order what you want, I'll order what I want. But I do think it's worth mentioning and acknowledging that this is perhaps an area for growth, just culturally, in letting others' preferences and values be something that intrigues us and teaches us more about who they are and invites curiosity about the person that we're engaging intimately right. with, right?
And I think opening that door, allowing for curiosity to take hold, is so important to increasing the amount of desire in a relationship. Like if your partner is really into something that they've never talked about, it's a super erotic conversation, at least it can be, to let go of the guard of feeling threatened from their diversity and invite them to explain why that's so hot to them mm-hmm. and how they've never been able to do it or try it or see it or whatever that looks like and be able to hold space for them. It's like, wow, it increases the fantasy, the sphere of fantasy, and it allows for the relationship to fill that space in a way that I think can be potent in a quality relationship.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I imagine when I hear this idea of being pure, being chaste, I hear it coded sometimes as a bit of avoidance, sometimes, as if you're walking down a corridor of closed doors hand in hand with your beloved. And I love the idea of just opening the doors on either side of the hall together and just like looking in, being like, here, this, I'm going to reveal myself. This yeah. is me.
This exists. And, here I am.
And letting it be met with the enthusiasm of opening a door you haven't opened before.
And I think it's okay if a partner opens a door and says, hey, this is a part of who I am. And if there's a little bit of, oh, that's weird. That's odd. I would never choose that. That's okay. If we were all the same, there would be no reason why we would want to connect. That's the way I feel. I think the diversity that we have in our sexual attitudes and our interests, while there may be a lot of commonality because we belong to the same culture, largely, opening those doors creates a huge amount of opportunity that I'm seeing. And not that I'm just seen, but I'm accepted. Mm-hmm. And perhaps there's even space to explore.
Mm-hmm. And at the very least, creating space in the relationship to say, thank you for the courage it took to open this. It doesn't even mean we'll walk through there together. Thank you for showing me. Thank you for letting me see you.
Because there's probably some reciprocating doors that we may want to then open for the spouse that then initiated the invite to look at maybe their hidden world a little bit.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think values is a really powerful part about this. So let's lastly talk about mutual pleasure. Not all things feel as good, right? There's a way to say that. And of course, there may be a variety of reasons why that's happening. I think in general, from a sexual health perspective, we would always say it needs to be a positive experience and something that you enjoy physically, emotionally, intellectually. There needs to be some pleasurable component to it that is receiving and important for you.
Mm-hmm. When I think about this principle, I think that this one is the most imaginative and the most, it's sort of like a call to show up for someone in a courageous and loving way and to show up for yourself that way too. So imagining what would be absolutely the most delicious scenario for you and then thinking, how do I either create that or approximate that? How do I ask for that and receive that? And then offering that to a partner as well. What's the most delicious thing that you can imagine? And then moving forward to involve the expansion of whatever kind of engagement that you're having, recognizing that sex doesn't always have to mean penis and vagina, but it can mean all kinds of stimulation with any part of your body, any part of their body, toys, fantasy scenarios, but letting it come from a place of integrity for oneself, where I'm really showing up for me I'm curious about this, or I want this, or I actually love doing this for you, but it's not the best thing for me. This is what the best thing for me is. And letting yourself be seen and loved in the way that you want to be, and offering that to another person.
I think it's important. Sometimes some forms of sexual engagement can be painful. Oftentimes women will experience pain during sex. It doesn't need to be that way. Mm-hmm. Men can experience pain too, but typically when we talk about pain or physical discomfort that's not pleasurable, I think that's something important to look at, because it doesn't need to be. And with most situations, I think they can be corrected or changed.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. If you're experiencing pain during sex, like, don't keep doing it the way you're doing it.
Correct.
It's okay to pause and have a conversation and sure. adjust as necessary.
And that's an extreme example, right? The lack of pleasure might be pain, but sometimes the lack of pleasure doesn't necessarily mean it's painful or uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It simply may be something that you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there's a variety of sexual things that some people would find distasteful, inappropriate, unrighteous, right? So there's the cultural labels that we apply to things. And that's fine. That doesn't mean that you have to engage in these things or talk about these things. I think it's important to know what your jam is, right?
Mm-hmm.
What you're into and what you're not.
Right. And context can even be important here, as well as like specific sexual acts. But I encourage clients to consider the times of day that they're trying to engage, how stressed they are. Are you trying to have an orgasm while your toddler is beating down the door? that's not maybe the ideal context. And so it's okay in this value of mutual pleasure to also say, for me, it's not a yes right now, because I know it won't be great for me if we try to do it right now while the kids are awake. But can we create a scenario that will be mutually pleasurable? For me, it would look like this. We leave our children behind and go to a hotel. Just kidding. Or whatever else
right.
we are able to do. But letting it be something that you feel free and able to talk about and explore.
Yes. Timing is important. I think we put a lot of focus in binary thinking sometimes around what a no means. And I think timing, context, time of day, environment are all things that need to be incorporated into what pleasure is.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the concept of pleasure is not necessarily, or we say sex, we think about intercourse. Sex, right, is the entire dance. It's the entire engagement, from sending a text like, I miss you. Like, what does that invoke? Do you like that? Or would you rather have me send a picture of myself, right? It could be provocative or not. Or just the anticipation, or the post-intercourse
snuggling
things, that, right? Snuggling, right? Or notes and things that we do. And maybe we should do more of those. I don't know. I'm probably thinking more about myself, but it's a big thing that happens that creates pleasure. It's
right.
not a transactional thing.
Right. No, I love that you said it that way, because it's sort of like, It is this river that we can drop into whenever we want, not just when we're actually here with our bodies. And so if the intention is to create mutually pleasurable circumstances, I think that's a wonderful thing to reflect on when we're doing just our household stuff, or when we're experiencing stress in our lives, right? Like, how is all of this impacting our ability to be relaxed and content and open with one another?
Fantastic. As I think about these six principles, I think it provides the scaffolding, a type of structure that allows for people to describe and to model what healthy sexual experiences, attitudes and behaviors and things look like. I think the church has done, for a variety of reasons, a disservice in not allowing for these conversations to occur. I think I'm seeing that more from a clinician's perspective, in that not everybody has a very committed, devout relationship with the church. And when that changes, while a certain structure may work for very believing members, as I've seen, when that changes, sometimes the porous nature of what a Mormon belief system around, air quotes, the law of chastity creates has some parts that are broken. And I think that this structure actually fills those gaps rather nicely.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I like to talk about when I present on grounded sexuality during a faith transition is the idea that many of our thoughts and ideas about sexuality were planted in us, that we didn't necessarily choose them. And that it is wonderful, you know, whatever your relationship is with the church and how you define that, it's wonderful to step into your own power. Give yourself the sex education that you didn't get. If you didn't get a great one in church, read all the books, listen to all the podcasts. like recognize that there are endless things that we can learn about ourselves and about our capacity for pleasure. And just committing to that can really bring a lot of, I think, peace and excitement.
For sure. And it's okay to choose from the building blocks that were provided to you as a youth, right? Maybe it is abstinence. Like if there's a, I don't know, let's say there's a 15-year-old boy listening to this podcast right now, and he decides, hey, I don't want to have sex before I get married because it's important to me. Yeah, tell me about why that's important for you. Like, do you know what that is? And what if that's the decision? I think that's a beautiful, powerful position to take.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need to be that way. And if it's not that way, why? And how are those decisions being made? What is informing what types of boundaries are being set up, and how are you educating yourself?
Right. Beautiful. And also just recognizing that, as you said earlier so well, abstinence doesn't mean abstinence of education or abstinence of learning in this way. And so I think creating something that is in line with integrity behaviorally, but also bringing some more maybe knowledge and even commitment to a partnership when that does happen.
Absolutely. Important. And parents, for those parents that are listening, please don't be afraid of educating your kids. They will not turn into debaucherous youth because they know what contraceptives are, or they will not increase in risky behavior because they understand what an orgasm is, right? The more information we give our kids, the more responsible decisions that they make. This is what is profoundly demonstrated from the research. And you can do that as an adult. If you're afraid, hey, if I read a book about sex positions, am I going to turn into a deviant? No, you won't. In fact, you actually might draw from that some really interesting things that would increase the quality of your relationship.
Also, deviance and debauchery have their place within safe, consensual relationships, too.
That's right. There is the animal within, right? And you mentioned this early on, and we didn't really go into detail about it. I don't know that we need to. However, sometimes we do. We think about, is my carnal nature, right, that comes out in my sensual experiences, is that righteous? You know, it does sex need to be whole, like holy and calm? Or can I be ravaged? You know, can I? And I really think, and this is kind of me channeling Esther Perel, but she's like, our society has taught men to be kind and soft and gentle. Sometimes that's appropriate. Sometimes that's amazing. And sometimes that's not what a female partner, if it's a heteronormative, you know, engagement, the female partner doesn't want that. She wants her male partner to be aggressive. Right? Has she talked about that? Have they contracted that into their relationship? Have they set up boundaries? This is the whole basis for many, you know, sexual things that we don't talk about or are otherwise not experienced, but it can be a good thing.
But certainly the six principles that we've outlined today, I think, are an excellent guideline just for understanding what sexual wellness is, and that it matters just like your physical health, your mental health, right? Like mm-hmm. So this is a good way to just kind of determine maybe areas for growth and change, and also presence with what is working and feeling good.
Rachel, I love what you wrote recently, and I think it provides some helpful bookmarking or bookending of what we've been talking about. Would you be willing to read some of that?
I wrote this after just feeling really moved after giving a presentation and sort of leading a discussion about sex, and just feeling so much desire for everyone to just be able to increase their connection to themselves in this way, to their own sexual selves. And so I want to share this with the intention of just letting this be something that, if it's been painful, can heal, and something that if you've been disconnected from it, that you can come home to yourself in whatever feels most natural, in whatever way feels most natural to you. All right. I wrote, sacred means connected to God or the gods, or if we want to call it the source of life or sentience or all that is, there's something vibrant about the feeling of being connected. Faith transition is a via dolorosa. Sometimes there's a tendency to release spirituality along with religion because there's been so much pain, but I believe the sacred is real. It's a way of living aligned with yourself instead of at war with yourself. It is treating yourself like the things you love and the things that hurt you matter. We do need spiritual healing. We do need sexual healing. We need to release the lies embedded in our brains and throats and pelvic floors. We need to hold our bodies tightly to comfort them and writhe and fling and bear down and birth out these old stories. We need to pour the brightest, kindest love into ourselves love ourselves enough to heal and let go and create new things, recognize ourselves as brief flashes of evolutionary consciousness, we can still heal. We can fight to make our time here beautiful and pleasurable and, yes, sacred and connected. Sex is sacred not because God is watching, but because you are. You are the soul experiencer. Your never before, never again consciousness born of water and of your mother's spirit. You are the beginning and the end. Sex is sacred because it is movement, it is change, it is potential, it is creation, it is life, it is yours, only yours, and you are living. You are alive.
That's so powerful. Thank you for bringing that. For listeners that want to get in contact with either of us, you can find me at Wasatch Family Therapy in Sandy at our new location. You can find that on the internet. And then, Rachel, tell our listeners how they could find you if they want to connect with you.
Probably the best way to find me is just through my email, which is wanderlight, W-A-N-D-E-R, counseling, C-O-U-N-S-E-L-I-N-G, at Gmail.
Fantastic. Thank you for coming and spending some time with us.
Thank you, Jeff. You're welcome. It's been delightful.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us and become a monthly subscriber at mormonmentalhealth.org. The goals of this podcast include education, advocacy, and the mental health and general well-being of Mormons and their families. We can't further this work without your support. Music for this episode was provided by the Lower Lights.
Over life's tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me, unknown way. Hiding rock and treacherous shore, chart and compass came for me. Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Peaceful rest. Then while he